Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Okay, what is God really like? Personally, I have come to believe this is the only question that matters in life. What you believe about God's nature and his personality affects everything else that you can think of. It affects how you live, it affects how you work, it affects how you pray. It affects how you understand love. It affects how you interpret evil. It affects the way that you see the world with all of its beauty and brokenness. It really is, in my mind, the only question that matters. Mark Galley is the senior managing editor for the influential US-based magazine Christianity Today. The last time he joined us, he'd written a book about Jesus. This time, the new book is called A Great and Terrible Love, and it sets out to explore that very question of what God is like. It's good to talk to you again, Mark.
Good to be with you.
This one question really does determine everything else, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And like you were saying, like how not only how we live our lives, how we think about life, how we interact with other people, and so on and so forth. Yeah, it's crucial.
Mm. And yet, you think of those classic words of J.B. Phillips, 40 years ago or so, when he wrote a little book called Your God is Too Small. So often we do reduce God down in some kind of way. You think about the people who are caught up in a God who is distant and perpetually angry, or, you know, maybe the more common one these days, a God who is just so loving, so caring that he wouldn't dare suggest we change our ways. Where do you think we go wrong when it comes to starting to think about God?
That's a good question. I think part of it has to do with, sloth, you know, because God is a being who is just bigger than we can imagine. Sometimes our brain just starts to hurt when we start to think about him. Sometimes it's a matter of just confusion. We just don't know what to think. For example, to think that God is a God who is righteous and holy, and that God is also a God who is love and gracious, we don't know how to put those two things together, so it's easier to not think about one of them and to think about the other one. And that's when we get ourselves into trouble. When we ever try to simplify God into a concept that we can easily grasp, we're probably no longer thinking about the God who created heaven and earth and the God who revealed himself in Jesus.
Yes.
Because he's a much more complex God than that, although not so complex that we can't understand something about him.
Yes, well, in fact, one of the traits that you mention in the book is the whole trait of mystery, that ultimately God is knowable, but there's, you know, we can't fully grasp everything there is to know about him. Otherwise, we'd be God and he wouldn't.
At one point, in some ways it's frustrating, in other ways, like you're saying, it's intriguing. I like to talk about, you know, when I got to know my wife, the fact that she was a mystery to me. I knew something about her that attracted me, but the fact that she was this huge mystery you know, pulled me into a relationship with her ever more deeply. I think that's the way it is with God. We know a little bit about him, enough to attract us. We find out more about him. That opens up new vistas of mystery, and that pulls us along even more in a great, what I call, a journey of attraction.
Yes, I like that, a journey of attraction. In the book, you talk about 15 character traits of God, and I think what we'll do is, you know, we could be here for 2 or 3 weeks if we go through each of one of those in any depth. I think we'll leave people to read the book for all 15 of those. But I want to pair a few of those ideas together and explore them in unison, because it seems to me that, just as we were saying, we kind of get God wrong when we think of, you know, one particular character trait above another. Let's explore some of those and then what it means actually for our lives for God to be this kind of God. Number one, the Bible tells us that God is above and beyond us. You know, we talk about, you know, God in heaven, us on earth, etc. There's a qualitative difference between who God is and who we are. Yet the Bible also talks about God being as close as a breath. Now, the technical words, we'll throw in a few technical words as we go along in our little crash course of who God is. The technical words are transcendence and immanence. What happens when we lose either one of those ideas? Explore them both for us.
Well, when we just concentrate on transcendence, the God who is infinite while we're finite, the God who is omniscient and omnipresent, and we're so limited in so many different ways, and he is perfect and we are not, that sets up a situation in which we become very lonely as people. It's like we're in the universe all by ourselves. God may exist, but for all intents and purposes, there's no purpose in his existing, because he is so different than us and so far from us in that regard. Now, the positive side of that, of course, is to recognize we are not God and he is God.
Mm.
mean, this is one of the reasons that, at least in the U.S., we have a resurgence of a group of people called the Reformed Christians, who are reemphasizing the magnificence, the transcendence, the sovereignty of God. And that can really energize people, because it helps them realize that they're not in charge of the world. Someone who is capable is in charge of the world. Mm-hmm. But the negative side is the one where it just leaves us alone in the universe. And that's certainly not what the Christian message is about God.
Yes. And so then we move to that immanence word, that God is so incredibly close to us.
Yes. And then that has an obvious appeal. Especially in people who move in more mystical directions of prayer. They talk about God being within them, you know, without going into pantheism, in which God is everything. Mm. There is a healthy way to talk about God being everywhere and, in a sense, penetrating all of existence. He's closer to us than we are to ourselves. That's a very powerful way of thinking about God, and in a lot of ways it's very attractive right now.
Mm.
The downside of that is when you watch in the history of religion, the history of Christianity, when people take that part of God's nature and just run with it, what you end up with is a God who looks very much like me.
Yes, yes.
A God who likes what I like, who wants me to do the things that I end up wanting to do, and pretty soon it becomes a pretty thin type of faith that doesn't lead anywhere but back into the self. It's sort of like a spiral of the self after a while.
So God is above and beyond us, yet he is also closer than a breath. Hold those two together. Okay, second phrase I want to throw your way. God never changes, yet God answers prayer. Now, technically, again, the word is immutability, that God's nature never changes. Some have actually understood that to mean that he doesn't change his plans or his mind either. And yet we hear right throughout the Bible where to pray, because, you know, God will actually answer that thing. So if God actually says yes to some things, no to others, is he not changing his mind, or is he not actually granting things or actually responding in some kind of way? Help us understand this idea of the unchangeable God.
Yes, I began the book with this attribute because I think it is the most perplexing for people in our time. And it's not just that the Bible teaches us to pray. It's Jesus himself who Christians believe is God incarnate, God with us, who says, yeah, pray. It can make a difference.
Mm.
And then we have examples in the Bible when the language of the Bible suggests that God somehow changed his mind as a result of prayer.
Mm.
So it is a conundrum because you don't want to be worshiping a God who is fickle, and who is subject to the whims of people like me, who I'm very mercurial, and I'm faithful one day, I'm unfaithful the next day, I want this thing one day, I want the next thing the next day. You don't want a God who's running the universe, who is just wringing his hands trying to please everybody, constantly changing what he's doing. In fact, that's not the God that the Bible reveals and shows to us. It's not the God that Jesus talked about. The God that the Bible talks about is a God who is strong and mighty, and that he has a plan, and that he has purpose, and he has a will, and that, in fact, the Bible uses language to talk about his will as being unchangeable. What he says he will do, he will end up doing. But the thing I find most helpful is to focus on God's unchangeableness in terms of his will for the planet, his purpose for the planet, and his love and mercy to the planet.
Mm.
Those things are unchangeable. Those things we can always count on. Those things we don't have to have a bit of doubt about, that God is a God of love and mercy who will bring history to its conclusion. He will judge injustice, and he will bring us into his kingdom. In a sense, he allows us to live within that and to, in a sense, play in that world,
mm-hmm.
if I can use that word.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I liken it to an illustration I use, my children, as they were growing up, my will for them was that they would learn to play a musical instrument.
Mm-hmm.
That was my purpose for them, and that was unchangeable. But when they came to me and said, I don't want to play piano, I want to play saxophone, or I don't want to play saxophone, but I want to play the flute, you know, I could bend with that. I could go with that, because
mm-hmm.
the big idea was the discipline of learning the music, learning to appreciate different types of music, you know, and all the other things that are wonderful about learning an instrument. He
yes.
has a plan for our lives, he has a plan for our planet, and that is unchangeable, and his love for us is unchangeable. But within that, he wants us, in a sense, have a relationship with him and have a dialogue with him and kind of work these things out as we move forward under his under his unchangeable will.
Yes, yes. I'm glad you also have included a chapter in this book about suffering, about the God who suffers, because while we're talking about this unchangeable God, the God who never changes, the Greek philosophers and some of the early Christian theologians who followed them in many ways often thought that God never suffered, because the idea went, well, if, you know, the unchangeable God suffers, that means something external to him has affected him. He's actually changed. He's actually started to suffer and feel something. That doesn't fit in any way to the God that I read about in the Bible, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, a God who does feel the pain and actually does say, bring all your burdens and cast them on me, and indeed a God who was revealed in Jesus is one who actually did weep.
Yeah, and that's probably the characteristic of God in the Bible, especially as revealed in Christ, that is the most unnerving to classical, what you call Greek philosophy, this notion, this very empathetic and passionate God, a God who goes to extraordinary lengths to woo his people to enter a relationship with him, who is in some ways mercurial to the point he's described in the Old Testament ways that make us feel uncomfortable because he's so either so passionately pleading with his people, as in the book of Hosea, the prophet Hosea, or so angry with them in other prophetic passages, and then let alone a God who would who in a sense would take on human flesh. I mean, just that notion in Greek philosophy by itself, that God would take on human flesh is an absurd notion. Mm. Yet it's something that stands at the heart of the Christian faith. So not only came in the flesh, but died, but suffered and died in the flesh. Yeah, this is an extraordinary message that Christians preach, and anyone who thinks it's boring doesn't understand what we're trying to say. We're not communicating very well what we believe, because it's an absolutely extraordinary, dramatic thing that has occurred.
This is Open House right across the nation, theopenhouse.net.au for the podcast as well, of our chat with Mark Galley, author of A Great and Terrible Love. We're talking about God's character. This is kind of a crash course in theology for some of us. We're using some of the technical words, but we're just talking about the God who is so huge, so big, that there is a certain mystery to him, and yet the God who revealed himself to us throughout history, and particularly, say, in the Holy Scriptures that Christians call the Bible, we're talking about a God who is both above and beyond us, yet a God who is closer than a breath, a God who never changes, yet a God who does respond to our prayers. Thirdly, let me put these couple of traits to you as well, Mark. God as a God of righteous anger, yet God as a God of loving mercy. His wrath and his mercy, let's brawl those, because we can fall again into one of two positions. We can be cowering before a God of anger, or we can forget that God is a God who actually does judge sin and evil. Help us to understand those two aspects of God's character.
Yeah, actually, this even though on the surface this sounds like it's even more of a contradiction than the others, in some ways I think we can get our heads around this a little easier. Because once we get through some of the what I'd call superficial understandings about what love and mercy is, the example I like to use that most people can identify with, because they've either been on the giving end or the receiving end of a parent's wrath. Mm-hmm. You know, a young boy runs out in the street chasing a ball and just about gets hit by a car. The car comes to a screeching halt, and the mother sees this from the porch, and she rushes out. She grabs the child. She picks him up by the arms, plants him on the sidewalk, and proceeds to just lecture him mercilessly. You know, why did you go out in the street? How many times have I told you to look both ways? You're not going to go out, and you're not going to be playing in the yard for months now. And nobody would look at that mother and say anything that she was being loving at that point.
Mm.
She's angry. She's wrathful. But the young boy, when he grows up, will say, that was really important, because I was kind of a thoughtless young man, and if my parents hadn't instilled in me some level of fear about traffic, I would have probably gotten myself killed.
Mm.
In that regard, we can see that parental anger is actually an act of mercy.
Yes.
It's one and the same thing. Now, for some reason, and I'm not quite sure why this is, it would be interesting to think about. I've not actually thought about it that deeply, but for some reason we find that a really easy concept to accept when it comes to parents and their children, or coaches and their charges. We expect them to kind of get tough with their players sometimes, and we assume that's a good thing. But for some reason, when it comes to God, the logic doesn't seem to make sense to us, and so we think it's a contradiction when God is is tough with people or is angry, shows himself to be angry in the Old Testament, or even Jesus showed himself to be angry in times.
But I wonder whether part of that is because we've actually kind of, you know, had this idea that God is angry, he is wrathful, he's going to strike us down at any moment when we actually sin or think the wrong thing or do the wrong thing or say the wrong thing. And yet inherent in just the illustration that you were talking about there is actually that God's anger and his wrath is actually, there's actually a disciplinary aspect to it because it's actually for our good in the end.
Yes. And the other part of it is, and I talk about this in the chapter on jealousy, because jealousy and wrath in the Old Testament are very much connected. The jealousy is connected to the wrath, and the jealousy is God's powerful love for his creatures. And when he sees them wandering off into something that's not good for them, he's jealous for their welfare. If my daughter starts to get involved with the wrong crowd and starts doing stuff that I think would be destructive for her, I am anxious about that. And an appropriate word is to say I am jealous for her welfare, and I'm really anxious that she give up those associations so she can move back into associations that will be good for her. This is a concept about God that we find it hard to accept, except when we apply it in the human situation, it makes perfect sense.
Perfect sense,
and, of
yes.
course, God is jealous for himself. And it sounds selfish until we realize that, whereas if I'm jealous for my wife to give total devotion to me, that's pure egomania, because I am not worth her giving her full devotion to me. But there is a being in the universe who is perfect in being and perfect in love and perfect in righteousness, to whom it is perfectly appropriate that we give complete devotion to. And he is only right to be jealous when we give our devotions to anything less than that perfect thing.
Yes, like you said, he's got every right to actually demand that. Secondly, I think also that idea that we do tend to become what we worship as well. And if the ultimate standard of the universe is a loving father and we run off to some other idol, whether it be money or whether it be a totem pole or whether it be a relationship or a particular person or even a celebrity or a hero, that we tend to become like what we worship. And ultimately, anything that we worship and anything that we actually model ourselves on, apart from the one true ultimate loving God, is going to be leading us down the wrong path too.
Yeah, that is well said. I couldn't say it better, yeah.
All right, God is a God of righteous anger, yet he's also a God of loving mercy, and those two are not that far apart. Okay, finally, God is one, yet God is three. This is the mystery that we call the Trinity. Now, we need to make very clear right from the beginning, Christians do not believe in three gods. It's some kind of amazing kind of thing that the scriptures talk about the Father as being God, the scriptures talk about Jesus, the Son, as being God, and the scriptures talk about the Holy Spirit as being God. How do we reconcile that? Well, we talk about there being one God who eternally exists in three persons. Now, for some people, that is just theological jargon, and it just is so hard to actually grasp. Again, it's that mystery, it's that kind of logical inconsistency that they kind of put it away and don't really think about it very, very much. And yet if we don't think much about this idea of God's tri-unity, we actually miss out on some aspects of his character and miss out on some understanding of our own nature too, don't we?
Exactly. You know, when people talk about the Trinity, a lot of times they think it's just this arbitrary doctrine that Christians have thought of to make life a little more difficult. But it really stands right at the core of what Christians believe, as you said, about the nature of God and therefore about the nature of people. And that is this. In a highly individualistic age, when they think about a person, they think what makes me who I am is my values, my beliefs, my everything. In the Bible, it's clearly spoken that we are created in God's image. And the one thing the Trinity reminds us is that God is not this solo, lonely, solitary being far off in a distant galaxy. That he is a God who is in relationship in his very essence as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And therefore, if we are created in his image, the most important thing about us is not ourselves as lonely individuals in the face of existential angst, but the most important and crucial identifier is that we are people made for relationship. God creates beings with personality who are only fulfilled when they're in relationship.
Yes.
Why? because God himself, our creator, is a God who lives in perfect, harmonious, loving relationship.
Yes.
So that's, I mean, when you start talking about the Trinity, there's just hundreds of ways in which it has these direct applications to our lives, but that to me is the most powerful one.
Yeah, I saw a TV documentary recently that put somebody alone in a room and saw how long they could last. And, you know, they were okay for the first few hours, and the next few hours after that, they started to get jittery. Next few hours after that, they started to be lying on the floor, and they started to be looking out the window. And then 3 days this particular person lasted before she just had to have some sort of human contact, and she actually pleaded to be released. Humans are built to be relational beings, and where does that come from unless it's actually that we're made in the image of a very relational God? I think you've put that so well. And it also raises that whole issue of love as well. Where does love come from? Love requires an object and a subject. It requires, you know, one person to give to another. How can God be a God of love if he doesn't actually have anybody within himself to actually give to? That would be some other arguments we could go down too.
Yes, exactly, and I talk about in the book how that it's that love that's the creative force in the universe. It's in a sense the way I imagine it is the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit have this dynamism of love within themselves that cannot help but break out of its own boundaries, because that's the nature of love. It always wants to spread itself. It always wants to break out, and in a sense, the overflow of the Trinity's love is the creation of the universe and the creation of men and women, the creation of the splendor of the planet. At the very heart of the Christian faith is this extraordinary image of a God who not only is love, but in a sense is a dynamism of love, and it is that dynamism that overflows into the universe.
Yeah.
And any love we experience today is a reflection of that love.
Yes, and that dynamism, that love, actually poured himself into a little baby boy born in Bethlehem. And I guess as we wrap up this, the person of Jesus ultimately becomes the one in whom we see all of these qualities manifest in some kind of amazing way.
Yes, exactly. And we wouldn't be able to speak with any confidence. Now, what Christians say about God, we don't know God fully, but what we do know of God, we do know truly. And the reason why we believe that is because who Christ is and what he has taught. And he is God come to be with us to reveal the nature of God to us. So in that regard, anything we know about God begins with anything we know about Jesus Christ. And, of course, the very fact of Jesus Christ, the fact that God would come in the flesh and would dwell among us and would suffer with us and die for us, in fact, every one of these traits, if we could look, at it through the lens of the cross and see some extraordinary things about God as a result of that.
Yes, yes. Well, Mark, thanks so much for this, I guess, the crash course in theology, we could call it in many ways.
Understanding, there you go, yeah.
Exploring God's nature, at least a small part of it. Thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome. I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, Mark Galley, who is the senior managing editor of the US-based Christianity Today magazine, but also the author of numerous books, the latest of which is A Great and Terrible Love.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.